This is Radio Health Journal, a weekly news magazine with the latest in health, medicine, and technology. A closer look at the issues that affect your health and well-being. Prevention, lifestyles, treatments and trends, all from the nation's top experts. I'm Shel Lustig.
I'm Nancy Benson.
I'm Mimi Tompkins.
And I'm Reed Pence. This week, how insurers may legally take what you win in an injury lawsuit.
Certain employers perhaps have a terminator attitude with regard to pursuing subrogation.
Then, medical hypnosis, what it is, and more importantly, what it's not.
The image of the nightclub, the silliness, the entertainment, that is not hypnosis, that is an act.
Then, a healthier world warns against overdoing that Valentine's chocolate. All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
Many adults with serious mental illnesses are dying an average of 25 years sooner than other Americans. In a new Mental Health America survey, people with schizophrenia and psychiatrists said overall health is vital to recovery from mental illness. Despite the increased risk for health problems, the survey suggests people with schizophrenia and psychiatrists are not discussing overall health to the extent possible. The survey also points to significant concerns about medication side effects, namely weight gain and diabetes. Nearly 70% of survey respondents with schizophrenia reported discontinuing medication because of such side effects. Dr. David Shern is president and CEO of Mental Health America.
We're deeply concerned about the health of people with schizophrenia since they're dying 25 years early. And what this survey tells us is that improved communication between people with schizophrenia and their psychiatrist about issues of diet, exercise, and medication side effects may help improve their overall health and extend their life.
For mental health information and resources, visit www.mentalhealthamerica.net.
Minor car crashes happen every day. If you're involved in one and it was the other driver's fault, they're on the hook for the damages. Typically, your insurance company will pay to get your car fixed. Then they'll go after the other driver's insurance company to pay them back. It's a well-accepted principle in property insurance called subrogation.
Subrogation is technically defined as the substitution of one person in the place of another with reference to a lawful claim or right. And insurance companies have had that right forever.
Gary Wickert is president of the Wisconsin law firm Mattison, Wickert & Lehrer, and one of the nation's top subrogation attorneys working on behalf of insurance companies. He's literally written the book on it, called ERISA and Health Insurance Subrogation.
Insurance subrogation goes back to the Roman days and was reinforced in the Magna Carta in 1215 and by our own Supreme Court back in 1799, so it's not a new concept at all.
Subrogation has been around a long time. It was recognized at common law, but only in the areas of property damage.
That's Roger Barron, a nationally known professor of law at the University of South Dakota, whose law review articles on insurance subrogation have been cited by a number of federal courts.
If your house was insured and somebody came along and burned down your house negligently or even intentionally, but if somebody burned down your house, say your house was insured for $80,000, you would have the right to collect $80,000 from your insurance company, and then your insurance company would have the right to sue the tortfeasor or the person who burned down your house and collect that $80,000.
Subrogation makes sure that a third-party tortfeasor, someone driving drunk on the road, a company that puts out a product without any safety concerns whatsoever that destroys the life of someone, subrogation helps make sure that that third party is made to pay. It holds them liable. If subrogation didn't exist, you would have a situation where two policies would be paying for the same loss. One, your insurance policy, and number two, the policy of the other driver. And that would amount to a double recovery, which is the second purpose for subrogation. It prevents a double recovery.
In spite of those factors, Wickert says in the past, many insurers didn't always seek reimbursement. It often wasn't worth the trouble. But these days, every penny counts, and insurance companies feel their financial responsibility to go after what they think they have coming to them. That includes health insurers, and that is something relatively new.
In an era where we're struggling to find solutions for rising costs of health insurance, I think it's important to remember that subrogation is a major part of underwriting, and it's a major part of risk for insurance companies. It helps hold down premiums. So if we want to hold down premiums for employers, which in turn will help hold down health care costs for everyone, subrogation is a good start.
Subrogation in health insurance doesn't happen if you simply get sick. Somebody else has to be responsible. For example, if your car is hit by a truck and you suffer serious injuries, you lose time from work and maybe have a permanent disability. In a case like that, you're likely to sue the trucking company. But how much is your loss really? Barron says in health cases, it's all a lot murkier.
In the property damage scenario, it makes sense. It's easy to understand. Your house is $80,000. You've been paid $80,000. Let's go ahead and give it to the insurance company. In the area of health insurance and personal injury claims, it's much more complicated to see if the insured has really been fully compensated, because we have not just medical bills, but we have lost wages, we have pain and suffering, and we have permanent disability to deal with. So it's a little bit more complex.
What's more, many insurance policies have caps on what they can pay out. So while you may have medical bills of $100,000 and a disability that'll cost $1 million more to care for the rest of your life, you might collect only a fraction of that from the trucking company in our example. But you might end up with even less than that. Increasingly, insurance companies are claiming that under their subrogation rights, they can then come after your settlement to cover the hospital bills they've paid, even if it leaves you with nothing.
People ultimately are surprised when they're in either a small accident or, God forbid, a catastrophic accident involving serious injuries or even death, and find out that all of the money they recover in a successful tort action isn't necessarily all theirs.
It wouldn't be so bad if there were some general rules there that would look at it on a case-by-case basis to see if an unfairness develops. In other words, in many situations, especially in small situations, somebody has a minor automobile accident, and there's maybe $5,000 in medical bills, and the person sues a tortfeasor and collects $15,000 or $20,000, then you can pay those medical bills back, and there's still money left over to pay the attorney and also give this person some compensation. But in some of these cases where there's not enough money to go around, where the person is catastrophically injured and they only recover the limit of an insurance policy, say maybe only $25,000 or $50,000, but this person is now permanently disabled and the medical bills are $100,000, where does this limited amount go?
Under most state laws, insurers are last in line, so any losses an insured person suffers are completely paid before their insurer can make a claim on what's left. But increasingly, health plans are claiming that state law doesn't apply to them. Wickert says insurance from a person's workplace, which means most Americans' health insurance, is covered by a federal law called the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA.
ERISA governs most employee welfare benefit plans, which is the plan you would receive and be covered by if you received your health insurance from your employer. As a result, ERISA federal law, which was passed back in 1974, has clauses in it which preempts state law, so state made-whole law will not apply.
When the ERISA statutes were enacted, they were signed into law in 1974, there was no such thing as reimbursement on health insurance. It simply did not exist. So when Congress passed ERISA, Congress did not address this issue. Since ERISA preempts state law, the controlling law of the state is avoided, and so this is a unilateral right undertaken by the plans, not subject to any supervision or regulation. They don't have to get permission of anyone to create this right of reimbursement. And that's where you see the real unfairness. That's where you see the really harsh claims where people who are basically normal before the injury and then they have a catastrophic loss and maybe totally disabled still end up with no money and they have to give it all back to the ERISA plan.
But Wickert says it's not as if every case of subrogation involves a catastrophic loss with an insurer swooping down to leave an injured person destitute. In fact, he says for every one of those,
there are 1,000 cases where the insurance company has paid out pennies and the injured person has recovered millions, and they still don't want to pay back the insurance company, and the insurance company is left with no choice but to fight.
However, given that the ERISA law says nothing about subrogation, there's no clear law guiding whose rights come first. There are 11 federal judicial circuits in the United States, and Wickert says each one has applied the law differently, creating a mishmash of conflicting court decisions. But the uncertainty may not last much longer. The Supreme Court may decide in the next week or so whether it will hear a Missouri subrogation case known as Schenck versus Walmart.
A woman was plowed into by a truck on the side of her minivan and had some rather catastrophic brain injuries. She received a meager $700,000 settlement, and I say meager, which may sound a little bit flippant, but in terms of health care running, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 a year, $700,000 won't really go very far. So she received a meager $700,000 settlement, and the plan had paid out about $470,000, and there just wasn't enough money to go around. And in that case, Walmart and their counsel insisted on recovering all of its money, which after attorney's fees left the injured woman with virtually nothing.
But if the court takes the case, who knows what they'll do with it? Are insurers right that they get first dollar? Or, as is the case in many states, would injured people be made whole before insurers can collect anything? Many advocates such as Barron endorse a compromise of prorated collection. If an injured person wins only a sixth of their loss, then their insurance company would get a sixth of their claim. He says there's already Supreme Court precedent for it in a non-ERISA case.
If the Supreme Court grants that petition, then there's certainly the opportunity for the court to adopt one of these compromise views, one of these views that we just don't flat out allow reimbursement 100%, but we look at that situation. And what's interesting is at least one justice on the court has made it clear that there should be this compromise view adopted.
But Wickert disagrees.
I don't think for a minute that the Supreme Court is going to take this case and say, we've decided that we're going to ignore the language of the ERISA statute, which is one of the most complicated, lengthy, and obfuscated statutes known to man, perhaps second only to the Internal Revenue Code. I don't think they're going to take that statute and say, we're going to ignore the fact that plans have a right to set their own terms, and we're going to apply a pro rata approach to these types of cases.
Wickert says when you hear of an insurer taking everything from someone who's been injured, prorated recovery sounds like a good compromise. But he says those cases aren't common and shouldn't be the ones on which the law is settled.
To be quite candid, I advise my clients in situations like this to avoid these cases with the plague. I will say that there are certain employers who perhaps have a terminator attitude with regard to pursuing subrogation, even in the light of some of the most atrocious circumstances. I feel rather strongly that insurance companies, although they have a legal right in those cases, should almost make a business decision that bad facts do make bad law, and judges do have discretion in a number of areas. A lot of times judges are going to come down hard on insurance companies who are too confiscatory and perhaps not compassionate enough in some of those extraordinary cases.
It's not exactly the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law, but if insurers didn't sometimes push their right to collect to the limit, they might not be in jeopardy of losing that right at all. I'm Reed Pence.
Coming up, medical hypnosis, when Radio Health Journal continues.
Uterine fibroids are benign tumors that grow in the uterus and can cause severe symptoms such as heavy menstrual bleeding and pelvic pain. A new study in the Journal Obstetrics and Gynecology shows that a minimally invasive procedure known as uterine fibroid embolization, or UFE, offers women a viable alternative to hysterectomy. Dr. Tara Hanjen of Columbia Presbyterian in New York City comments.
The 3-year data shows that UFE is an effective long-term treatment for uterine fibroids. In the study, women treated with UFE experienced sustained improvement in quality of life and symptom relief. UFE offers a much shorter recovery time and is a less invasive procedure than hysterectomy, which can cause numerous physical and emotional after effects.
To find out more about uterine fibroid embolization or to locate a physician who performs UFE, call 1-877-ASK-FOR-UFE or visit www.askforufe.com. That's askforufe.com.
We're about 6 weeks into the new year now, and if you're like most people, your New Year's resolutions have probably fallen by the wayside. Maybe you haven't been to the gym lately, and that diet, well, they never last long anyway. So what now?
People make a resolution, go on a diet, it lasts for about 2 days, then they say, well, I better get some help. So they go to some commercial weight loss program, and that lasts for maybe a week, and then they think about it some more, and then they finally call us. Hypnosis is not generally the first thing that people choose.
That's why right about now is the busiest time of year for certified hypnotists such as Catherine Johns, co-owner of Positive Changes Hypnosis Center in Chicago. She says people need a little extra incentive before they try hypnosis. Sometimes they need to get over some pretty serious misconceptions. The American Medical Association has recognized hypnosis as a valid medical therapy since 1958. But Johns' partner at Positive Changes, certified hypnotist Karen Hand, says many people still think of it only as entertainment.
You don't think that we're going to make you quack like a duck? Bark like a dog? Yes, people do walk in and think that. Catherine and I have done some trade shows or fairs where we'll have our sign up and people will walk by and not make eye contact with us. Don't look us in the eye.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is you can't hypnotize somebody against their will.
State of hypnosis is a state of very deep relaxation. One is awake during it, alert, aware, in control. It is not at all like the way it's stereotypically portrayed in the entertainment venues like nightclubs or on sitcoms on TV or in the movies. Contrary to popular myth, you're not out of control, you're not under someone's spell. You're simply very relaxed.
Dr. Ron Glassman is clinical director of Ivy League Clinical Hypnosis Center in New York and author of The Alpha Solution to Permanent Weight Loss.
When the body is profoundly relaxed, it means that the heart rate is going very slowly, breathing, respiration rate is very slow and shallow, brainwave activity has slowed down. And if this sort of sounds familiar, it's exactly what happens whenever we relax for any purpose. Whether it's zoning out in front of the TV, reading a book and practically sort of fighting to keep your eyes open, if one meditates, if one is in the state of deep state of prayer, or just as someone is falling asleep at night or for a nap, we all pass through natural states of very deep relaxation.
When you're watching a television show or reading a book and you're lost in the story and completely involved and somebody might come into the room and say your name, and you don't even hear them, you're in a hypnotic state. And that goes on in your regular life all the time. And so what a hypnotist does is help you harness that and use it to achieve some objective.
Often the objective is to get the subconscious and conscious minds to agree, because Glassman says if they're in conflict, any resolution is bound to fail. For example, smokers may consciously know that cigarettes are bad for them and want to quit, but their subconscious has been trained through repetition to expect a physical and emotional lift from smoking.
The subconscious is blueprinted to want to smoke, and typically in very specific situations, driving, after a meal, upon waking, with coffee, whatever you've blueprinted yourself to do, and you find yourself sort of doing it on autopilot. What happens is during hypnosis, because we're relaxed, because we're more focused on intention, there's that key word, intent, the subconscious mind becomes more open and receptive to intention in that very profound relaxed state. So think of it as a time when you can help bring the same kind of understanding that your conscious mind has, that you don't really want or should smoke, to the subconscious mind. And if the conscious and subconscious minds can be on the same page, then they're no longer in conflict. So you don't get that conflict between, I know I shouldn't do this, but I want to do it. If you don't want to do it both on the conscious and subconscious level, there's the end of the conflict. Resolution has taken place. You don't want to smoke anymore.
However, sometimes the conscious and subconscious mind are already in agreement, in opposition to change. Those people show up for treatment only under pressure, and Glassman weeds them out as patients.
If they say, you know, I know I should, but my wife is dragging me in here, and, you know, and to get her to stop blabbing in my ear every day, I'm going to come in and do it. Well, that's not a client for us. The chance of that person not smoking is about 1 in 10. The person who comes in wanting to stop because they want to, almost 9 in 10 people I work with stop smoking within 1 week.
I had a 72-year-old woman who came in and said, I don't really want to quit smoking, but my husband's afraid I'm going to die and my kids are on top of me all the time. So can you make me want to give up the cigarettes? No, can't make you want to give up the cigarettes. Sorry. But we can help you along the way. It took her 7 sessions, but this woman gave it up. What we finally got down to was it was her last rebellion. A decade before, she'd quit drinking. She quit cussing when she had kids. She quit all these things. It was her last link to youth. So as we helped her rectify that and decide that she really wanted to be with her grandchildren and do these other things, and she admitted that, and that was the last hurdle, she gave it up.
All 3 of our experts say that the success rate for hypnosis in getting people to quit smoking is about 90%. The satisfaction rate for weight loss is nearly that. Hypnosis can also be used for medical conditions that you'd think have little to do with the subconscious mind.
Actually, it's one of the most effective means of helping IBS, also known as irritable bowel syndrome or colitis. It is effective for chronic pain, not acute pain, but that steady kind of gnawing pain that doesn't respond to medication sometimes, or medication doesn't completely eliminate. It's effective and has been used for many, many years to help women deliver babies with less anesthesia for a small number of people, small population of women, no anesthesia at all. The range is fairly broad.
Han says fibromyalgia can also be receptive to hypnotic relief when nothing else works. But despite all those uses, Glassman says the vast majority of patients are interested in changes that are the bread and butter of resolutions. Weight loss, smoking cessation, managing stress, and conquering phobias. Not that those are minor. Han says virtually anyone can be hypnotized to their benefit, and the mind can be a powerful ally. You can find out more online at positivechanges.com or at medicalhypnosis.info. Dr. Ron Glassman's book, The Alpha Solution, is available at bookstores and online. Our production director is Sean Waldron. I'm Nancy Benson.
There's bad news for women who are chocolate addicts. A new study shows there may be a link between eating chocolate every day and having brittle bones. I'm Mimi Tompkins, and this is A Healthier World, exploring issues of global health, brought to you by Pfizer. Not only does chocolate taste good, but many studies in recent years have shown that eating chocolate can protect the heart. But new research appearing in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition will be a cold shower for chocolate lovers. It shows there's evidence that eating chocolate on a regular basis may not be good for the bones. Researchers looked at about 1,000 women aged 70 to 85. The women were taking part in a study about calcium supplements and the risk of breaking bones. The authors of the study found that the women who ate chocolate every day had weaker and thinner bones than other women. They also had weaker bones in their heel and tibia, which is the shin bone. This is the first study to look at the relationship between chocolate intake and bone structural measurements. And the findings show there's a relationship between how often people indulge in chocolate and their risk of osteoporosis and bone fracture. There are some possible reasons why. Chocolates are rich in flavonoids, which some studies say are good for the bones. But chocolate also contains oxalate, which blocks the absorption of calcium. And the sugar found in chocolate can speed up the excretion of calcium. The researchers found that the women who ate chocolate every day had a 3.1% lower bone density on average than women who ate chocolate just once a week. The women in the study all ate the same amount of fruits and vegetables and consumed the same amounts of saturated fats. The authors of the study say more studies are needed to confirm the connection between eating chocolate daily and having brittle bones. It could force a change of life for many women, but help make millions of lives healthier. I'm Mimi Tompkins.
Medical notes this week. Most other industrialized nations have a birth rate that's going down sharply. But here in the United States, the birth rate is up, way up, to the highest it's been since the baby boom. A new government report shows that there were 4.3 million births in the U.S. in 2006, and that births were up for every age group and almost every racial group. However, births were up the most among Hispanic Americans, which contributed nearly a quarter of the total. Experts say contraceptive use and abortions are both down, contributing to the birth increase. In fact, the first complete study of the abortion rate since 2000 shows that the abortion rate in the U.S. is at its lowest since 1976. The Alan Guttmacher Institute says abortions dropped 9% between 2000 and 2005, in part because abortions are more difficult to get. And finally, we all know people judge us by how we look and sound, but apparently, barely detectable odors also make a difference in whether people like us or not. Northwestern University scientists subjected research subjects to pleasant and unpleasant odors as they judged the likability of people in photographs. When smells were just under the level that they were consciously noted, they strongly influenced how participants judged the photos. And that's Medical Notes this week. More in a moment.
The FDA approved Tecterna HCT tablets, the only high blood pressure treatment to combine Tecterna, the first approved direct renin inhibitor, and the diuretic hydrochlorothiazide, HCTZ, in a single once-daily tablet. Tecterna HCT marks the first regulatory approval for a single-tablet combination therapy involving Tecterna. HCTZ is a diuretic or water pill and is one of the most commonly used high blood pressure medicines. Cardiologist Dr. Alan Gradman from Western Pennsylvania Hospital.
Clinical data show that the combination of Tecterna and hydrochlorothiazide is an effective combination for lowering blood pressure. This is an excellent treatment option in patients who require more blood pressure control.
For more information about Tecterna HCT, talk to your doctor or visit www.tecternahct.com. Tecterna HCT and Tecterna are prescription medications for adults used to treat high blood pressure. Tecterna HCT is not indicated as initial therapy. Important considerations. Warning, avoid use in pregnancy. When pregnancy is detected, discontinue Tecterna or Tecterna HCT as soon as possible. Drugs that act directly on the renin-angiotensin system can cause injury and even death to the developing fetus. Do not take Tecterna HCT or Tecterna if you're allergic to any of the ingredients in the product you are taking. Do not take Tecterna HCT if you have a history of reduced urine output or have allergic reactions to certain drugs called sulfonamides. Tell your doctor if you take lithium or cyclosporin, or if you have ever had a reaction called angioedema to an ACE inhibitor medicine. In clinical studies, the most common side effect experienced by more patients taking Tecterna than patients taking a sugar pill was diarrhea. The most common side effects experienced by more patients taking Tecterna HCT than patients taking a sugar pill were dizziness, flu-like symptoms, diarrhea, cough, and tiredness. Other less common reactions to Tecterna include cough. Other less common reactions to Tecterna and Tecterna HCT include skin rash.
And that's Radio Health Journal for this week. This program is a production of MediaTrax Communications. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order online at radiohealthjournal.net or call 847-299-9500. Join us again next week for another edition of Radio Health Journal.